Yes. Mike, is that real behind you, or is that a, oh no, it's not. I see you've moved your head. It's not. But it's a photograph of a real place, probably very close to home, is it? Gwen was arriving there a second ago, and then Gwen didn't arrive. I presume she'll. Oh no, Gwen has arrived. All right.
I just say, Willie, that the universe worked in my favour today because I looked at your response to one of my comments that was see you later today, and I hadn't planned coming on today because I thought I'd done it last week. So
All right.
that was perfect because I was like, is it today? So I had to go and check and went, oh yeah. So thank you for that.
I was talking, Dennis, I was talking on Facebook Live yesterday about the universe working in one's favor. I didn't put it that way at all, but I was talking about it purely from a practical perspective, from a business perspective, because I was making the point that, I just wait for Justine to come in. Justine might appreciate this. Because Shelley, you were there yesterday. You know what I'm about to say. I'm forever talking about how finances flow when you're doing the right thing. You see, an awful lot of business people, business leaders get tied up in the financials. And this is coming from an accountant, bear in mind. And I'm forever making the point that when I stop even thinking, occupying my mind at all about where business might be coming from, it always flows. And I often tell the story of how there's this little place in Beaujolais country. It's about 2.5 hours from here by car that we would stay in fairly, well, fairly regularly, might be once every 2 years. But every time we go there and I open my laptop, as one does when you work for oneself, there's always unexpected business there. Myself and my good wife went up the mountains for our first trek on Sunday. And we came back at about 4 o'clock, absolutely exhausted. And I said to her, I just want to check my emails before I do anything else, because I'm sure we've got a piece of business. And I was wrong. We got two pieces of business out of the blue on Sunday afternoon when I was doing something completely different. This has always happened to me when I'm up the mountains, when I'm skiing, when I take a couple of days off, or when I'm very often when I'm gardening. And I know, Justine, things have happened to you just when you were out going for a walk, to go for a walk, when you least expect it, when you're not thinking about it. I think that's the key thing. And we think too much. We overthink. We think that we can plan things so that they will happen in a certain way. And that's not the way they happen at all. I don't know which one of your presidents it was, Dennis, who said that. Plans are rubbish, but planning is indispensable.
Yeah, I'm not sure who said that, but yeah.
It doesn't really matter who says
Yeah,
it.
it's interesting. I've heard the term a lot lately, effortless effort. In other words, when there's no pushing and doing and trying to make something happen is when you're allowing something to emerge. And it's like a leader of an organization saying, I want my employees to be more engaged. I want them to be more happy because it's been proven happy employees create happy customers. So I'm going to do everything I can to make them happy. Well, the making part, I think, is what organizational leaders are constantly challenged with, and if they will create an environment to allow employees, for example, to kind of be themselves, emerge, give them opportunities for creativity and innovation without the pressure that you're doing this so we can make more money and return, earnings to our shareholders and put that kind of stressful pressure on people. We actually end up shooting ourselves in the foot and creating a corporate culture that is counter to what we're really trying to create by allowing people innately to, you know, bring out the best of themselves without coercing them or creating this, you know, environment of the goal being more important than the process to reach the goal. I've got a new consulting client that I'm going to be flying out to California in a couple of weeks, and I'm convinced they're already at a world-class level of performance. They just don't know that they are. And so it's a matter of connecting the dots and creating kind of a collective aha for them to see that what they have done, from what I can see, is create this culture where they, for the most part, trust their employees to, you know, offer and engage in a way that they're putting their heart and their soul into their work, not because it's a children's hospital and not because they are trying to, you know, make so much money. And in fact, they are profitable and they are making money, but the money is the byproduct of the culture and that environment that they've created. So I don't know if that kind of really relates to what you're saying, but it's...
Yeah, I think there are a couple of key things to emerge from what you've just said. First of all, you can't make people engaged. It's like saying we're going out on Friday night to have some organized fun. That is when the fun does not happen. The fun happens spontaneously. Engagement happens if you've seeded the vegetable patch, so to speak, of the employees of the employees turning up. I think, you know, I'm interested in what you're saying in relation to leaders trying to make an environment in which employees are engaged. You can't, as I said a minute ago, I know you can't make anybody engaged. You can't make anybody happy. You can't command somebody to be creative either. But there are things leaders definitely need to do. Actual practical things, never mind, you know, the more ephemeral thing, like, you know, the need that we all have to turn up to the present moment. One of the things that leaders need to do is explain to their employees, this is going to sound stupid, but it isn't, explain to their employees why they go to work. I have a client in the pharma industry, and when she took over the running of a particular plant, she went around the couple of 1,500 people in the plant and asked them, why did they do what they do? And most of them said, we do what we do because we were told to do it this way. And we're not really sure why we do some of the things that we do. And we really don't have a clue as to the greater why. Now, there's actually research that shows that if you are trying to do anything and you don't know why you've been asked to do it, you're going to find it damn difficult to do it. You'll muddle through all right, but you'll burn an awful lot of neural energy in the process. Whereas if people know why they have turned up for work, for example, and there's obviously a bigger aspect to this as well, but if you know why you've turned up for work, it becomes an awful lot easier because you know why you're trying to do something or why you're doing a task in a particular way. We obviously need to know why we got out of bed this morning as well in the greater scheme of things. But that's another day's work altogether, perhaps.
Yeah. But would it be fair to say, though, that I guess there's a couple of things. And by the way, hello, everyone.
David, hello. Today? Sorry, we were in full flow.
No,
when you
I saw that. No problem. Listen, I wouldn't want to get in the way of a river flowing, really, right? Okay. And yeah. But there's a few things that I guess come to mind. First of all, I absolutely agree the whole thing about trusting a process. You know, we were talking earlier on about, you know, for a walk and not overthinking how business is going. And it's probably the thing that amazes me the most is that it probably took me around 50 years to learn that, right? Just to trust the process, okay? Yeah, my focus was always on the goal, right, rather than actually on the process. The goal will look after itself if you look after the process and trust the process, right? And I still struggle with it even today, right, despite knowing it, right? The whole engagement of the creation of optimal environments is, I find, really interesting, right? It's something that I do in my own business on the kind of business development side, right? Okay, it's about trying to create optimal environments. And it occurs to me that as a business owner, you almost have to do it by stealth today, right? And I say that maybe on the back of my, definitely on the back of my own experiences, right, rather than anybody else's, right, that in lots of businesses, right, there's almost a conditioned opposition, right, about, well, what's the next big thing, right? What's the next big campaign the company are going to bring in, right? And almost immediately that you announce it, right, okay, well, that's never going to work, right? How's that going to happen, right? And it occurs to me that actually almost, and again, the conundrum in this is, how do you bring something in by stealth? You don't talk to the people to whom you're bringing it to, right? So it's a real conundrum in that whole process, and trying to find some way to navigate an understanding as to, in terms of what that should be, is, well, I guess that's where experts like you come in, right? Okay, in terms of the best way to do it.
David,
it's an interesting one from my perspective, because it does feed into what I try to do myself, right? Is how do you create that trust amongst employees that what you're trying to do is something that is for their benefit and not for the benefit of the company?
I think you gain people's trust by lying to them. Now, obviously, I have my tongue half in my cheek when I say that, but I'm actually working with one particular company at the moment that is has just got a huge amount of investment pumped into it from venture capitalists, who obviously have their own agenda. And they want to increase revenue, top-line revenue, by a factor of 18. The leader of the organization knows in his heart and soul that actually they could probably, because they're coming from quite a low base, increase the revenue by a factor of 30. I said, whatever you do, don't tell anybody, because they won't believe it's possible. And then they will start pushing back against it. And then they will actually collapse the whole thing in on you. I mean, you know, I've said to people for the last 25 years, be very careful who you tell your goals and dreams to, because people will say that's unrealistic. People will say, you know, I'm not party to that if I'm an employee, for the simple reason that it is unrealistic. And what you're doing is setting targets for me so that, for example, from a commercial point of view, sorry, that's a French word, I mean, from a sales target point of view, I'm never going to get my bonus. So in other words, it's a question of messaging. Dennis is probably biting his lip there on the basis that I said, you know, you gain their trust by lying to them. And my tongue was half in my cheek when I said that. It's a question of always saying the right things in the right way to move people forward. And again, we can every day ensure that we do our planning for that, but having a plan for that is rubbish. Because our minds need to be agile enough, first of all, to realize that we're dealing with all kinds of different people who all have their own version of reality, many of whom will not take anything for granted from a leadership position anymore. I'm talking about perhaps millennials. They all want to know why, which is actually a very good thing rather than a bad thing on the basis of what we said a minute ago. Sorry, I'll keep quiet, but certainly, you know, one more analogy in relation to that, because I was reading something from Thich Nhat Hanh, who, Dennis, I know you know, and a couple of others on the call know Thich Nhat Hanh as well. And he tells the story of the Vietnamese boat people heading out to sea. Is probably when were the Vietnamese boat people? The 1990s. And obviously going out to sea in craft that were not seaworthy, over full of people, just running away, not knowing where they were going. And he said panic would set into any of those boats like that, except all you needed was one person with a calm and steady mind. All you need is one person to know where a team is going. All you need is one person to know for sure, body and soul, where an organization is going. And that comes back to the point that Dennis has made again and again and again, that the way an organization behaves cascades down from the way the leaders behave. If the leaders behave in a certain way that subconsciously impacts those around them, all the other paraphernalia of the corporate world, like business planning and targets, all the financial paraphernalia, pales into insignificance because you have a group of people who end up trusting you because you did turn up in a certain way.
It's incremental. It's slow. It's incremental. It takes time, I would suggest, in terms of how you get to the place you need to get to properly introduce the, let's say, the ideal working environment.
Yeah, I think it does take time.
One of the concepts that kind of builds on the starting with why. In fact, there's a book that Simon Sinek, I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's called Start With Why. And he's done research, and the great companies he has found that he has studied, the CEOs and the senior leaders are able to articulate at a daily basis at meetings when they walk around their company, the why of the company. And the reason for that, he says, you're engaging hearts rather than engaging heads, because people engage in a sense, it's an emotional experience to engage. You can't think yourself into engagement. Yeah. Engagement occurs through a feeling, an emotion, which is typically associated with the heart, whereas the goals, the measures, the finances, that's all mental. It's a mental measurement system for success, but the measurement system isn't the goal. And even reaching the target, if you start with why and you engage people, he says, Simon Sinek, from the heart, people will do anything. They will lose their life literally for a company or a cause because they're so engaged and it's become their purpose. And he says it's the role of the senior leader and the CEO to create meaning for the organization and the company. When I'm employed, if I'm just interviewing for a job to make money, and that's why I'm there, all I do is I go in, I make my money, and I go home. I have no life at work. All my life is at home. Well, if there's that balance and the person has more meaning with their day-to-day work because they're engaged, they're able to be creative and innovative, and people actually ask what they think. They just don't tell them what to do. They empower them. They ask for their input on decision-making, all these kinds of engagement factors. We call that in the Baldrige world. There's actually a list of engagement factors, engagement drivers, they're called. And this is all evidence-based. It's been researched that if you focus on these drivers for engagement, you can create a corporate culture that aligns back to the mission and the vision and the values. But it ultimately, it's the mission, the vision, and the values that are so compelling that the employee jumps out of bed every day and just wants to get to work because it's fun, it's exciting, they can be creative. It's not just another day at the salt mine, you know, hacking at something just to get a paycheck. So to me, that's the transformational role of the leader that Willie's talking about. If the senior leaders look like they just come in every day and with a hangover and they're just kind of going through the motions and their meetings are boring, there's no excitement, there's no passion in the company, there's no feeling, then no wonder the company is flat. So the senior leaders have to start with their own self-awareness. And that kind of goes back to these conscious conversations I think we've been having over the last several weeks. It starts in the mirror, looking in the mirror in the morning when you get up and you're looking at the person or a person, one of a member of a team that really creates that culture for better or for worse. Hopefully it's for better. If you wake up and you're more self-aware, then you can leverage these engagement drivers and really become more conscious as a company versus unconscious and just going through the motions of getting, you know, product or service or whatever out the door and then go home at night. And, you know, so I don't know if that makes sense, but it does,
Dennis, right? And I guess I'd have two questions, right? What's the biggest challenge to that? And how do you make it sustainable?
Well, and I've got another question. Dennis, can you address the third one, which is what about, can we go back eventually to the boat of the Vietnamese people? And if there's one person who is calm, it can impact the whole boat. So does it have to be the leader? Because sometimes there isn't a leader yet. And it could be, I'm saying it could be an employee. So that's I'm wondering.
So
that's my question.
So go to, well, I'll start with you, Gwen, because now I've actually forgot. David, you're going to have to repeat your question.
Okay.
Gwen, I totally agree. A leader, we're all leaders. And you can have work groups or smaller groups in a company, and there's a leader of that group. The CEO typically by title is the leader of the company, but absolutely leaders can influence the people around them in these different work groups. And it's often you see in a company what I call subcultures. I work for an organization here in Tucson, and I was the rehab executive for a hospital system. And there was one department, the speech language pathologist, who had this stellar culture that was really created by the leader. She was the manager of speech services. But within our culture of rehab, which we had, you know, over several hundred employees, she had 20 speech pathologists who, in my opinion, were stellar. And because of her leadership, she created this stellar subculture within our larger culture. Now, getting back, David, to your question.
Can I interrupt you?
Oh, sure, go ahead.
One moment, because I know David is going to repeat his two questions in a moment.
Right.
Just in relation to Gwen's point, I actually think the point that Gwen is making goes even deeper than just subcultures and, say, teams within an organization. You can have somebody on a leadership team who is not the chief executive and therefore not occupying the leadership position, who is de facto the leader as a result of the way in which he or she holds himself, behaves
Absolutely.
Himself, herself, and actually engages with other people. And a really good chief executive will simply let that out. A really good chief executive won't care whose idea is the best idea.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I was going to add to that as well, because I don't know whether it's relevant to your question, Gwen, but the importance of differentiating a manager from a leader as well is always a key one for me. And within the example of the boat and the boat people, for me, within that context, the leader emerges, right? Mm-hmm. Someone actually who may not even expect themselves to be that leader, right? But because of the situation they find themselves in, actually, they find that some kind of innate natural ability that they have comes forth, and they actually start to be the leader in that situation. If that makes sense, Gwen. Right. Dennis. Yeah. So the two questions I had in terms of this, the environment that I guess we're talking about, what's the biggest challenge to creating that environment, and how do you sustain it?
99% of the challenges that I have found with the organizations that I've worked with, the challenge is the senior leadership group. They're dysfunctional. They don't walk the talk. They espouse, you know, really these values that they don't personally really embrace and embody. And it's not the frontline folks, it's the leaders who actually are creating that dissonance, and that, you know, they're perfect role models for how not to be. And it needs to be flipped. The senior leadership team needs to be the role models for the entire organization, because you have to create that coherence. We like to use that word, organizational coherence, or almost thinking of it as an energy that you're trying to create, you know, a harmony within an organization. But if the senior leaders are dysfunctional, they argue, they never agree. I've shared before, I once worked for a CEO who felt like it was his job to create chaos. That was his job. And if he sensed harmony, he'd go in, he'd say something off the wall, he would offend somebody to create this conflict, because he believed conflict was good, and therefore it was his job to just keep everything stirred up. Unfortunately, the company worked in a crisis management mode, and then he would complain about, why are we always, you know, reacting as if we're under a crisis? Well, damn it, you're creating these crises without knowing it. He had no self-awareness as a leader. So, you know, to sustain this, you have to continue to walk the talk. I mean, to me, that can be a cliche, but if you're not embracing the values, you know, really, to me, it comes, you talk about the triangle. I like to talk, there's a mission, there's a vision, and there are the values. And you're not going to accomplish your mission without your vision. Well, your vision is where you're going to, but the fuel for that is the values.
Yeah.
And it's the values are the why. And if you can't articulate the values in a company, which gets really to the way you treat human beings, you know, gets down to human kinds of things here, not, you know, concepts about bottom line and goals. It gets into respect, integrity, teamwork. These are some of the values I typically see in values statement. Integrity, teamwork, honesty. If you say those are your values, you better well live those values, because if there's a dissonance or lack of coherence between the, you know, the values, then you're not going to have a sustainable culture, and organizations in place will just see it's a flavor of the month. Oh, they're doing something new this year. They're rolling out a new program. This isn't going to work. It never has. Why should this one? You know, you get into that spiral
I understand, Dennis. And although I would suggest that probably 90% of businesses will have those words in their mission vision, and probably 90% and probably 10% don't. And probably 10% actually embody them, and 90% don't. Now, maybe that's a cynic in me, but that's my experience. Again, that's my experience, right? Okay, in terms of how it lives. And yes, there are these momentary wishes, right? Okay, to build something different, but the pressure changes. Once the pressure points change, everything that you want, okay, starts to turn into everything that you need, which is driven by who's ever above you looking down. And the challenge that I found is you can have all of the best aspirations, right? But unless, you know, the CEO or the board of directors or the next level up and the next level up, the next level up are bought into those, then things change and wants turn to needs, and needs then turn back to old cultures in terms of, you know, how we support the bottom line. So driving that aspiration up is almost, actually it's probably more critical than actually, not more critical. I think that from a time perspective, it's the first thing you have to do before you start driving it down, right? Because that buy-in has to be there. It has to be recognized as something that's going to be challenged and still needs to be sustained above before you start bringing it in to the levels below, where, you know, once it starts to waver at all, everyone's off it. Everyone's gone. Right. And that for me has been the challenge, I think, in relation to some of my own experiences. Right. From, yeah. But yeah, that makes sense to us.
Yes, it's some of the strongest organizations in the Baldrige world that I work with over here have incredibly engaged board of directors over the CEO, and there really is a coherence and a harmonization between the key leaders of the board and the key executive officers of the organization. If you're trying to push something like this up, I hate to say, but I don't think pushing is going to do it. I can see Willie smiling.
You're making me uncomfortable now. Talking about pushing boulders up hills, basically, is what you're
exactly
talking about.
Yeah, put on the boots and get in the mud. It almost, your role as a leader is to create an aha experience so that the light bulb goes on. And there's, you know, an art of doing this is creating moments. I like to call them perfect moments. They're a little different than what Willie talks, but actually they are the same thing as a perfect moment, is where you are telling a story, and finally whoever you're telling the story to, the light bulb goes on and they have this insight, enlightenment, illumination, any word you want to use, that it's an aha that, oh crap. You know, we've been doing this to ourselves. If we all will get on the same page here, we're going to have a very effective, aligned, and integrated organization, almost naturally, without any effort, just allowing it to be in harmony. You can't make something in harmony. I used to play saxophone in an orchestra and a jazz band. You can't force harmony. If everybody's playing their instruments and they're in harmony because of the rhythm and everybody's in sync, you have music, but you can't force music. And it's the same with the company.
I've been trying to play the banjo for 10 years and I still haven't got it, Dennis.
He's just playing on his own.
I mean, to me, a CEO is kind of the conductor of the orchestra. The basic job of a CEO, in my opinion, is to do nothing. And this can sound kind of radical, but the CEO's job is to stay in their conscious state of mindfulness and allow the people around them to do their job. Don't micromanage them. Get out of their way and just keep reminding everybody why they're here. You know, what's the vision? What are our values? Walk the talk. That's it. That to me, it's an easy job, actually, but actually it's so easy it's hard, because most senior leaders think they have to push, make it happen, you know, control the organization, and that the whole mindset is counterproductive to what it is they're trying to accomplish, and they become their own worst enemy. It's not their company, it's them, because they haven't trusted and allowed and let go of the need to be the chief controller. And that's tough, because the reason many people got to that level in the organization is because they were good controllers, and that's kind of how that was their, you know, their ability, their career progression occurred because of their, quote, as you say, David, managerial skills, not necessarily leadership skills. At some point, somebody wakes up in the morning. Every manager, in my opinion, is a leader. There really should be no differentiation between I'm a manager and a leader. I mean, a manager should be a leader, but oftentimes it's the senior leaders who want to create this segregation between leaders and managers, and they're really shooting themselves in the foot, I think, by doing that. Because, you know, how do you empower managers if you're kind of thinking of them as lesser leaders, you know what I mean? So
I have a question on that for you, but actually, Shelley, did you want to
Yes, please. It was just, I mean, I know it's not business, but I'm a retired teacher. So to show the leveling out of values and equality, I would teach something from the front and then a child would put their hand up and they clearly knew more information on that. So I would then write, so let's swap seats. I'll sit in your seat and you go and tell the class about what you know about that. And then somebody else would come up, well, I know about, right, okay, well, you sit in their seat and we swap over and it's your turn. You go, you know, and to me, I see that as being applicable within a business environment.
Without a doubt.
You know, you just, as you quite rightly say, Dennis, the job of the CEO is to get out of the way of the people who are the ones that know their bit, know their slot, you know, better than anybody else. And I also, I've been following recently Trevor Blake, multimillionaire. He works from a room in his home, but he's the CEO of a huge company that is actually made up of separate companies. His wife died of cancer and there was an issue about provision of certain machines that were needed to help in the hospital. So he used his money initially to then speak to one company and say, well, making the machines, what is it that's holding you up from making enough machines? This company, that supplier, whatever. So he then found the next company and he spoke to them. I want to be able to put out more machines that are more available to help people from this illness. And he went all the way down the line to the suppliers. He's got suppliers. You know, he connected all the dots with a different company that were all motivated with the same mission of providing these valuable machines. He sold his companies that were involved in that for millions of pounds. He then wrote a check to every company from that profit made from that sale, because he did not do that mission to make money.
Yeah.
He did it to make more machines available. And the, you know, when you have a passion, and in fact, almost underlying in all of that is that getting out of the way of the people who know how to do their job the best,
yeah,
and how to come up with challenges or solve problems, things like that. When you get out of the way, the best people, like going back even to the boat with the person where there's the problem, there's a, you know, the problem going along, who's got the solution, and out comes that natural, instinctive genius, you know, the inspiration. And you know, he is a great bloke, because he says, I don't know anything about computers and technology. That company does that. I have no meetings. You know, if somebody wants to email me, that's fine. You know, he said it's the role of a leader to be always available and approachable. You know, I don't sit in a separate section. And going back to what David was saying about pushing up and pushing down, to me, it's about squashing the whole lot flat. You know, there is no up or down. And to me, the leader doesn't stand above, below, in front, behind, but with. And you do it together because you're all motivated to achieve the same thing. And, you know, it doesn't, you know, to me, we've spent so many years always being profit driven. So I see the future as being non-profits or ways of actually making other people benefit and their own needs are met in other ways. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, that's helpful. That's helpful, Shelley. The one thing I wanted to ask, actually, because I know historically my challenge has been not getting out of the way of people, right, and actually getting too involved. Right. Is there some, I don't know, publication or I don't know what the right word for it is, okay, that I guess brings this forward with some degree of clarity in terms of how to get out of people's way. I don't know whether it is a book recommendation you guys might have or something along those lines that works towards that.
David, you need to get out your own way first. I mean, that is the key challenge. In fact, that is actually the only challenge, because you asked a few minutes ago, what is the main challenge to, you know, cascading this down through an organization or getting everybody walking through walls or you know, working to within an inch of their lives, as Dennis said a few minutes ago. And if a leader's role is to enable, is to provide the environment in which everyone else flourishes, then they need to be so completely out of the way of the other people that they are just, as Dennis said a few minutes ago, the conductor of the orchestra. Yeah, they're not they're not playing any instrument. The only way you can do that, it's awfully simple. Actually, we could boil it down to there being only one challenge. There are no challenges in business. There are no challenges in life. There are things we have to do. There are obstacles around which we have to work or go over them. There are situations that we need to face up to. But all of those things are made an awful lot easier when we rise to the challenge of managing what's going on between our own two ears. Because once you get out of your own way, it's awfully easy to get out of everyone else's way. In the same way as once you are motivated, it's awfully easy to motivate other people. All you need to do is get out of your own way. Because when you get out of your own way, the ego that many CEOs wear on their sleeve and slap people around with it every day, the ego vanishes. Because the ego is only a product of the thoughts that do get in your own way. You can get out of your own way in two breaths.
Looks like I got a bigger problem than I thought then.
No, you don't. You only think you have a bigger problem than you already thought.
Yeah, no, very good. No, listen, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you. It's good stuff.
I mean, it always comes back, honestly, to self-development and self-awareness and to get into to allow yourself to be versus do from a state of mindfulness typically requires some kind of meditation or discipline or activity where you allow yourself to let go of you know, that need to feel that you're the doer, that you're the one that's making all this happen. Whereas in reality, you're probably doing nothing and you never have and you never will, because you're witnessing this activity. It's almost like you're sharing this state of awareness that you are. And it's gonna, I know it sounds a little strange, but I really think the consciousness, there's a corporate consciousness, there's a corporate culture. You know, we like to, there's books written on corporate culture, but what the heck is that? Well, it's a collective consciousness. And it goes back to the leaders. And again, I find the most unconscious organizations are led by very unconscious leaders. And the more conscious the leaders become, the more conscious the organization becomes. It's almost through osmosis. It just seeps out.
It just happens.
And it's through every interaction. You could probably use quantum physics to explain it, actually, on an energetic level, because we're actually putting out energy from our brains and our hearts. But we don't need to go down that rabbit hole. You can just experiment with this, you know, at home. You can do it with your dog, actually. You know, pets are very responsive to feelings. And you can watch the reaction in an animal if you're in this state, and the animal very quickly will respond to kind of your state of being. I mean, I've seen that myself with our dogs. and I'm not saying you're, you know, running your organization as if you had a bunch of pets, but
it's our dogs,
you know.
Dennis, that's a really interesting point, because obviously I've been coaching leaders for a quarter of a century. And the really interesting thing, obviously, they come to me in the first place to enhance their leadership skills. And that's actually a quote from somebody who had just been given a leadership position in an organization and thought he'd be a lousy leader because he was introverted. So we started talking, and on the third conversation that we had, he said, the most curious thing has happened. And I said, what? He said, my wife thinks I'm a nicer person. This is exactly what you're talking about.
Right.
And the number of times over the years that people have said to me, actually, I'm getting on better at home, or people close to me are really noticing a difference. And you see, they can't put their finger on what the difference is, but the difference is that the person in question has actually, possibly for the first time in their adult life, turned up. Or if we can use the language we were talking about a minute ago, got out of their own way. And it does just happen. Interestingly enough, you know, something has just occurred to me in relation to getting out of the way. And the point you made a minute ago, Dennis, with regard to what got people into leadership positions won't make them great leaders and may well not get them any further, because very often it's technical competence that gets people into leadership positions as they progress through their career. I have one particular leader I've been working with probably for a dozen years at this stage, and I was talking to him on Friday. And he was he's been in charge of a global cluster of manufacturing facilities in a large pharma company that are all biotech. They all make this aseptic processing. And he knows aseptic processing inside out and backwards. And he said, the great thing is, over the last number of years, as I led this group of people, is I know more about the technicalities of what's going on each of those, at each of those production sites, than the site leader does. And horror of horrors, I've just been given a completely new network of medical devices about which I know absolutely nothing. He said, what am I going to do? I said, this is an absolutely wonderful opportunity. You've lost the comfort blanket of your technical competence. Now you're going to have to go and be a leader. And you can't get in their way by saying you should be doing it this way or that way, because you don't know enough to be able to say that. It's a wonderful opportunity to get out of the way completely and see what happens. I'm interested as well, Dennis, in your analogy of the CEO being the conductor of the orchestra, and the fact that if yourself and David got together, the chances of you playing harmonious music are nil. But that's David's fault, not yours, Dennis. Sorry, that's an aside. It's interesting that cognitive psychology uses exactly the same analogy with regard to the components of the subcortical brain, the doing brain, the being brain, and that the brain's central executive is just the conductor of the orchestra. The problem when we use our minds normally, and you said there was a 90-10 rule earlier on, David, I think Harvard would say it's a 96%, 4% rule.
Makes sense to me.
I think they've still understated the 96%. But the problem when we use our minds in a normal fashion is there is a great dissonance between the key components of our subcortical brain. They're like musicians tuning up and never getting around to play a tune. Whereas if we engage the left prefrontal cortex of the brain, the central executive, the conductor of the orchestra, our brains end up playing harmonious music, and they do it effortlessly. That's how you get out of your way.
Make it sound all too easy.
And a truly harmonious orchestra doesn't even need a conductor, because if those musicians are in tune and they're reading from the same page of music, just to be honest, the conductor doing this, they're just going through the motions. I've worked in a band, and the band leader would get off the podium and go to the bathroom, and we continued playing our song. You know, we didn't need him, but he looked good, and he kind of kept us all in the same rhythm. And, you know, to me, that's that synchronicity or the coherence. It's a beat. It's a rhythm. It's keeping people together, but you're not making them. You know, the conductor doesn't make the musician follow that beat. They are willingly, they are choosing to follow the beat. Okay. He can't make them do that. If somebody in the orchestra wants to get out of tune or change the beat, they can. Who's stopping them? But they willingly appreciate the beauty of the music they're making, and it's the beauty, it's the joy of the music making that's really creating that harmony. It's not the conductor. It's an illusion. In my opinion, the conductor is like a metronome, you know, tick tock, tick tock. Sure. There's creating that harmony. You put a bunch of grandfather clocks in the same room, and over a course of time, all those clocks will synchronize. I don't know if you've heard about those studies. Well, this happens with human beings, I'm convinced. You know, the leader's job, the conductor's job, is to create that coherence to where we're all kind of ticking and beating, you know, in synchronicity. It's not mystical. I think, you know, this is a physics thing we're dealing with there, probably. Mystics like to talk about it.
Yep. It's an animal thing, Dennis. We're all animals, ultimately. We all communicate instinctively. Even our DNA is affected by our intercommunication. Our energy is certainly affected by our intercommunication. The problem is most people aren't intercommunicating because they're buried up there. No, I'll stop myself right there. They're buried in their own thoughts.
That'll do. That'll do, and inevitably true as well.
Yeah. And you know, the thought you might be buried in is, how can I get out of my own way? Which is a thought in itself.
Oh yeah.
Get out your own way.
I'm working along that path at the moment. I have to say, in terms of trying to get out of my own way, and I'm trying to become more of that conscious observer, than as much as I can. Right. And
We had that conversation before. Yes, we did. As much as your baggage will allow you.
That's right.
Yeah.
So far.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, going back to what Dennis was saying, there is a lot of science behind it. I mean, the one that I remember is the 100 metronomes. That you set one, you set them all off, and then after a period of time, they then all sync up. And it can happen again with where you have an audience clapping for an encore, and then after a while, instead of the random clapping, it then becomes a joint clapping at the same beat and the same rhythm. You know, it's a resonance that creates that synchronicity. Very much, I think resonance has and synchronicity have great importance with being able to align with the flow of where your heart feels that it needs to go. Because, my image is that we're all on this journey. So your body, your body is the car, if you like, and your mind is the passenger and your heart is the driver. However, the mind likes to be a backseat driver initially, the ego. It likes to tell you what to do, where to go, and why you should be doing it. But ultimately, you have that crossing over point whereby you get the heart consciousness, and then the mind then be able to sync up with the heart to then actually become enabling you to then go forward on whatever your life path is, and following, you know, whatever your heart's desire. And I do feel that undermining a lot of successful people and successful businesses is that four-letter word. It's love. And I do see that as a futural thing, and a thing for the future, so that if you love yourself, if you love the people you work with, if you love what you do, then the money is a byproduct.
Even at a corporate level, one of the most successful airlines in the United States is Southwest Airlines, and their tagline is love. And if you sit waiting for their planes, you see on the wall, love, little, you know, it's not just a cliche. I mean, they are trained in engaging people, listening skills, you know, showing respect, you know, all these things. And up until recently, Southwest Airlines, which started in Dallas, Texas, in the 80s, has never had a layoff. Now, I think they had to do some furloughs, but they were bringing people back after COVID. But they were trying to show that love, Shelley, to their own employees by saying, if you get a job with Southwest Airlines, I don't care how bad off we might get financially, you know, we're not going to lay you off. And because they've been so successful, because the focus is on their people. So they're focusing on their employees, and the customers are having these outstanding customer experiences because there's so much focus on the values of their own people. So this kind of gets back to where we started it, when we started this conversation, of that getting back to the why, that they discovered the why is a form of love. And, you know, it's a respectful way of interacting as human beings. So, and I think companies for years have not allowed, in a sense, the discussion of emotion and feeling and words like love. And, you know, that's not a business thing. Don't talk about that. That's the stuff you do at home or with your spouse, or, you know, and it's like, you can't segregate life into these boxes. Human beings are emotional feeling beings. They're not just mental, you know, widgets to create and produce things. There's you know, more to a human being than we sometimes give ourselves credit for. Perhaps we have, you know, infinite ability in some ways to do things that we can't even imagine what we, you know, can do if we would step back and allow ourselves to be open to that kind of.
I know you guys will appreciate how seismic a change like that is, right? The whole use of the word love within a corporate environment. I know you do, and I guess it was more. I guess engaging with what Shelley was saying, right? Okay, and a lot of what you're saying, Shelley, it sounds like the Holy Grail, right? Okay, in terms of trying to find the right way of identifying it, and actually, I would be definitely, I'm on the side of it being the Holy Grail. Right. Okay. What's very clear to me is that I really haven't a clue how to get to the Holy Grail. Right. Okay. No, I'm working along that. Okay. I'm working along that road, and I'm comfortable that I'm making small little steps in that direction. Right. But how do you remain? Sorry, word for it, aligned to that kind of almost a belief. I mean, I can see there's a belief in you, okay, that this is the way it should be. How do you sustain that belief, I guess, is what I'm asking you.
I think history teaches us to have the mindset of, I'll believe it when I see it. But the way forward is actually believe it and then you'll see it. And I know that is not a concrete, substantial answer that you perhaps would like to hear. It's, I think, because for me, it's about the It's the research. It's what I know about mind, body, and soul. It's what I know about quantum physics. It's what I know about astrology and numerology, and how it's not just about energetically people being connected, but it's actually everything is connected. And when you have an open mind to be able to absorb that, you do believe it. For example, to me, people say a lot of stuff is mystical, but actually astrology is based on science. Numerology is based on science. You know, there are lots of things that are believed to be sort of like woo-hoo, but now this, you know, quantum physics is now catching up with the mystical stuff. There are lots of ancient stuff, traditional stuff that we've had that have had a bad name in the press, so to speak, but actually can be quite empowering to the individual when you start to look into that. Like with Dennis, the heart maths, with Willy, his understanding of the mind, you know, to me, I'm mind, body and soul. So I tend to touch on the more, the woo-hoo stuff, as they say. For me, because I'm a visionary, so I can, and when you're a visionary and you listen to the, you know, selective ones that resonate, astrologers, the numerologists, the quantum, the science, the various people who are experts within their own field, because I've done all that, I can join all the dots together. So I can see where the future is going. And there's also the science behind, and Willie knows this, and Dennis and probably the rest of you, is that when you visualize, the more energy that is put into that visualization, it's always as within, so without. So you end up creating that reality. And I know that at the moment out there in the world is not reflecting what, I mean, I know of groups of thousands of people who are doing different meditations at the moment in order to calm the violence, as has been done in the past. There are peaceful marches that are actually not being shown on the news. And we'll get there. It's just that we have to, like when you're trying to create the new building, you have to demolish the old one. And when you're going through that demolition process, it just gets a little bit messy. And I can only just say that if you do your research, if you go into this, you know, if that's what you want to do, you want to go into the astrology, you want to go into the people who are able to back up and support the science behind all of this as well. It's not just a vision of hope. It's going to happen because for 10,000 years, the energy is completely changing, and it will be. We are now evolving as a human race from head consciousness to heart consciousness, which is why everything is, you know, I can see everything just tipping completely the way around, but it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take, you know, at least another decade to get there. But it's more to do with about the number of people who have an awakened consciousness, who are not asleep. So when all the sleeping beauties are, you know, we have a predominant amount of sleeping beauties that have awoken from their sleep, then we will have that energy to be generated to the forward vision.
We just need a tipping point. But I think probably the key thing, and unfortunately I'm going to have to go in a moment now, The key thing is that we can be the tipping point in our own lives and in the lives of those around us. I'm not going to change the world overnight, but I can change my own world overnight. And in doing so, I can have an impact on the worlds of those whose lives I touch, even remotely. I think that's important from an energetic point of view, from the perspective of how quantum physics looks at things.
Very good. Very good. Thanks, folks. That was great.
Justine, good to see you. Gwen, good to see you. Mike, good to see you. David, thanks for joining in. Dennis, as always, good to see you.
Thanks,
Shelley, thanks a million for your contribution. Sure. This will be online, as it always is, tomorrow. I think I forgot to send out the link. I forgot to tell you the link was there a couple of weeks ago. But this, you can take it. It will be online first thing in the morning in the usual place. And I'm sure we will continue the conversation.
Sounds good. Thanks, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.